From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Dallas sports the nicknames Big D and Cowtown, but it came up a bit short in its most recent bid to become Titletown. Ahead on Only a Game, a report from Dallas where the Rangers temporarily saved Texans from the Cowboys. Also a conversation with the most accomplished female golfer of all time, Annika Sorenstam. Also, Sprint football players attempt to explain their downsized sport to gridiron fans with big questions.
They don't understand that it's all the same football, you know, it's just the weight restriction. They're always asking, what is it, flag football, is it touch football? And you just have to explain to them, like, you know, everything's the same, it's just the kids are a lot smaller.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NFL gave us another week of controversy, contention, and confusion. Here to discuss the ins and outs of the NFL's Week 8 is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on, Bill.
I hardly know where to begin, but perhaps it's with Randy Moss, now a Tennessee Titan, after wearing out his welcome in New England and Minneapolis in this relatively young season. Is the league's number two all-time pass reception leader really as bad a guy as some make him out to be?
Oh, no, I'm sure everybody's wrong. I'm sure the whole world is wrong about Randy Moss, and he's really a prince among men. And honestly, what he is there's two kinds of bad guys. There's bad guys who are criminals, and there's bad guys in the non-criminal division. He's among the league leaders in the bad guy non-criminal division.
How many teams do you think he can play for by the end of this season?
He could play for a good five more, because you have to figure the Bengals, Cowboys, and Raiders are all due a turn, because they're all three run by total morons. So I could see four more teams in his future, but maybe he lasts at Tennessee. We'll see.
After all the headlines about shots to the head 2 weeks ago, the Eagles' Ernie Sims was fined $50,000 and James Harrison of the Steelers was fined $20,000 for illegal hits. Is the league failing to get its message across to the players?
No, I don't think so. I think it's starting to resonate right now. The dollar amounts are going higher. People are starting to notice. It used to be, yeah, a guy would get fined $5,000 or $10,000 and everybody would kind of smirk and wink and continue to lay out the lumber. So it's having an impact. Now, it hasn't eliminated it. I don't think you'll ever see the elimination of illegal hits. The game moves too fast. The testosterone's flowing too high. It'll never completely go away. I do think you're going to see a tipping point here real soon.
Was Troy Polamalu correct this week when he characterized the league's policy as, quote, paranoid, and criticized Commissioner Goodell for wielding too much power?
Well, I think part of that, yeah, he was correct. Paranoid, no, I don't think so. I mean, we are seeing people get hit to the levels of, wow, is this guy going to wake up ever? You know, we've seen some brutal hits in the last couple of weeks that were not accidental hits, but just brutal, wow, that guy could be dead on the field there. So, no, I don't think the NFL is paranoid. I do think Goodell has too much power. I really like Polamalu's argument that maybe they should have some sort of a separation of power like our government has, and it would be nice, because right now Goodell decides how much he's going to fine you. You appeal to Goodell, and then Goodell has to argue with Goodell and decide if Goodell was right or Goodell was wrong, and it's a little bit much.
The New England Patriots have the league's best record. They're 6-1 right now. Do you think they'll remain at the top of the standings throughout the rest of the season?
Yeah, they didn't skip a beat without Randy Moss. Now, the question will be Tom Brady, and can he stay healthy, and can his long hair, will he not trip over at some point that Justin Bieber do he's got. But, yeah, they're very good. They've got the best coach in the business, if not the best quarterback, one of the best two or three quarterbacks in the business. There's no reason. Some teams you'd look at and you'd say, wow, there's something wrong there. There's a fluke there. At some point, the law of averages is going to even out. They're going to start losing. The Patriots, with that coach and that quarterback, they're not that team.
Dallas receiver Roy Williams is confident that the 1-6 Cowboys can go on a run and make it to the playoffs. Greg, we're a radio station. We have a laugh track here. Should we cue it?
Oh, that was me. Yeah, you can do that if you want. Look, I was at the Cowboys' last game. It was it had to be rock bottom. It had to be, because they got trucked at home by a bad Jacksonville team. They're not any good. Their quarterback is out. Their coach has no respect in the locker room, so it's not like he's going to whip those guys into shape. He's the anti-Belichick. They're not going anywhere, and the Super Bowl is going to be played in Dallas without them, which is a shame because that would have been a great story. The Super Bowl in Dallas with the Cowboys would have been a great story as a media person. I kind of wanted to see that, but no chance.
Some thought that the 0-7 Buffalo Bills would grab Randy Moss back on Wednesday, but they didn't. Do the Bills feel they can go 0-16 without him?
Well, yeah, the Bills can go 0-16 with or without anybody. They will lose. It doesn't matter who their quarterback, coach, receiver, anybody is. The Bills did add this week Sean Merriman, and I don't understand that. You're 0-7. You're not going anywhere. Why are you adding Sean Merriman? Why are you spending any money at all? Why are you doing that? There's a reason some teams are good, and there's a reason the Bills are the Bills.
What other teams have you been following that are worthy of mention this week?
Well, I really like the Baltimore Ravens because they started the year with a loss, and there was all kinds of havoc around Baltimore. Oh, no, what's wrong with our team and this and that? And now they're 5-2. They're winning the AFC North, or at least they're tied with the Pittsburgh Steelers for first place. As usual, they're going to be in the playoffs, and they're tougher than most teams. Them and Pittsburgh, it's a shame they're in the same division because those are probably the two toughest, meanest teams in football. And it'd be nice if they could meet way down the road in the playoffs as opposed to possibly early.
All right, I've got the standings in front of me now, and I see an awful lot of 5-2 and 4-3 teams. Is this parity or just mass mediocrity?
Isn't it the same thing? I know Pete Rozelle wanted parity, but parity is, by definition, same thing as mediocre. I mean, do you want to say six or a half dozen? Either way, unless you're in a city like Buffalo or Dallas, you think you can win every Sunday, and that's what will keep people coming to the ballpark or the stadium, even in times like this when it's still money's a little bit tight. So I think parity probably nowadays is what the NFL needs.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and, of course, he joins me here on Only a Game from time to time to tell me about football. Greg, thanks again.
Oh, thanks for having me on again, Bill.
From the time the Dallas Cowboys opened their new stadium in Arlington, there was always the possibility that the Cowboys and the Texas Rangers would play on the same day, on the same street, less than half a mile from each other, but few expected that the Rangers would be playing in the World Series when it happened. Only a Game's Karen Given was on hand for that historic event and has our story.
From the moment wheels touch tarmac at DFW, it's clear that we've entered Cowboys territory. A limo driver meeting his client at baggage claim complains that the boys just can't catch a break. And a debate breaks out on the bus to the rental car lot as Cowboys fans and Vikings fans try to determine who has it worse. It's the day after the Texas Rangers' first ever World Series appearance. After a tough loss, they're down a game to San Francisco. And unexpectedly, I find my first Rangers fan at Cowboys Stadium. His name is Daryl Moose Johnston, a star fullback for the Cowboys from 1989 to 1999. He's now a football analyst on Fox. But today, he's joining the rest of North Texas in rooting for the Rangers.
When you're talking about football season, the Dallas Cowboys are on the front page of the Dallas Morning News. Well, the Texas Rangers have changed that this year. They have been the talk of the town. And this is a football town. It's a football state. It's Friday Night Lights. It's everything that exists, high school, college, professional. But for this year, right now, at this time, it's about the Rangers.
1,000 people have come to Cowboys Stadium to mark the 100-day countdown to the Super Bowl. Most had hoped to see Dallas become the first team to play in the Super Bowl at home. But despite one of the highest payrolls in the NFL, the boys have lost every game but one. And they've lost star quarterback Tony Romo to a broken collarbone. Cowboys owner and GM Jerry Jones is disappointed, but he can still find honor in the team's lost season, at least in front of the business people who are buying sponsorships and expensive suites in his $1.2 billion stadium.
It's about getting up. It's about getting knocked down. Not very many really thrilling times compared to all the butt kickings you get playing this game.
At Sunday's game, the Cowboys are getting another one of those butt kickings. As Dallas heads to the locker room at halftime, down 14-3 to the Jaguars, the crowd actually boos. After the game, Coach Wade Phillips takes his seat in front of cameras, looking as downtrodden as a coach can look.
I've got talented players, and I'm not getting them to play well enough. And so that's, that, to me, that's the root of the problem. I'm at a loss right now, certainly, because I don't. If I knew what to do, I'd already done it. I got to go back and reevaluate and look at it again.
Fans streaming out of Cowboys Stadium are greeted by helicopters and planes circling the Rangers ballpark in Arlington, just down the street. The parking lots for the two venues are connected by a pretty little footbridge. Willie Miles can't help commenting as he crosses the divide between Cowboys and Rangers territory.
Now we walk from the losing side to the winning side.
Miles attended the Cowboys game in person and is heading home to watch Game 4 of the World Series on TV. Even though he calls himself a die-hard Cowboys fan, Miles says it would be worse to watch the Rangers lose the World Series than to see the Cowboys not win another game all season.
It's good because we get the number one pick. Hey, we're going to lose that lose big, right?
Jerry Wiestinger and Orlando Sandoval are occupying their favorite tailgate spot in the Rangers parking lot. With tickets to both of today's games and a perfect view of the Cowboys and Rangers stadiums, they're taking a break between their NFL World Series doubleheader.
Y'all hear our section? Yeah. Our whole section
was saying. Rangers, go Rangers inside the Cowboy game. That's how bad we are right now.
But don't feel too badly for these fans. The Cowboys might stink, but Arlington is over the moon about the unexpected success of the Rangers.
It's okay. We got a winning baseball team. Give us one or the other. It's okay.
We've been on the winning side as a football team. So, you know, 5 Super Bowl rings, we couldn't ask for no more. So it's Rangers time now.
Two days later, Rangers time has ended and the Giants have gone home with the World Series trophy. The skies have opened up over Arlington, even though the locals tell me North Texas is currently in a drought. And James Godwin from Ovilla is buying a few last World Series trinkets in the Rangers team shop while television screens pump in ESPN interviews with happy Giants players. So how are you feeling today?
Good.
Yeah?
We had a great season. If I would have been asked opening day if I could have had the opportunity to be at a World Series last night in our own stadium, I'd have been tickled to death.
In the lobby of City Hall, a bronze statue of Tom Vandergriff, the mayor who brought the former Washington Senators to Arlington in 1972, is dressed up in a Rangers t-shirt and cap. As he readies a shipment of congratulatory barbecue for the mayor of San Francisco, current Arlington Mayor Bob Kluck smiles and says his town is still proud of their team.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm very happy they got there. I mean, that itself was quite a feat. And sure, I'd like for them to have won the World Series, and sure, I know they will eventually, perhaps next year.
Even the prospect of losing ace free agent Cliff Lee won't keep Rangers fans from dreaming about next year. As for Cowboys fans, well, Cowboys fans might as well start rooting for that number one draft pick. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Fly back to Dallas.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. As the days before the midterm elections dwindled down, Ohio's Lee Fisher, running for the U.S. Senate, made what he hoped would be the king of political ads.
What should I do? Should I throw in the towel because my opponent gets his money from Wall Street and the lobbyists?
A majority of Ohioans voting on Tuesday apparently were less than wowed by Mr. Fisher's spoof of the LeBron James Nike commercial. He lost to Republican Rob Portman, who vowed to fight for, quote, private enterprise, personal responsibility, and limited government.
What should I do?
I don't know, Mr. Fisher, but I hear the Cleveland Cavaliers have an open roster spot. Why not give that a shot?
I'm Lee Fisher, and I approve this message.
Yeah, and then I horsed around with it. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a smaller, if not kinder and gentler, form of football. But first, the men's college basketball season begins this week. Here to discuss which hopeless squads are entertaining the delusional hope that they can possibly derail San Diego State from their 2010-2011 NCAA championship cakewalk is ESPN's Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, and go Aztecs, Bill.
Yeah, I did say San Diego State, but I meant Duke. So tell me a little about the team that begins this season ranked number one.
Well, Duke certainly... certainly begins the season number one for good reason. Most of the key players back from the championship team last year. Mike Krzyzewski, I think, just kind of adding to his legacy with just now the longevity to be able to win titles in the early 90s and 2001 and then again in 2010. It's really been an extended run of winning titles unlike any we've seen in college basketball. And Kyle Singler back, Nolan Smith, they've got one of the best freshmen in the country, and Kyrie Irving. Every reason to believe that they deserve to start the season number one.
Michigan State starts the season at number two. They made the Final Four this past March. Do they enjoy similar success this year?
It seems like now it's almost mandatory for Tom Izzo to find a way to get to the Final Four no matter what. Every year they get picked high and then they struggle and they have injuries or they have chemistry issues or something doesn't click. And then all of a sudden when, you know, it's do or die time, they do. They win all their games till they get to the Final Four. So, they had a great run in 2009, an even better run maybe in 2010 of the Final Four. And this is another team that on paper looks like it very much deserves to be in the place it is starting here.
Louisville, your neighborhood, has a brand new downtown arena that head coach Rick Pitino says has the feel of an NCAA tournament site, but maybe the real question is, will the currently unranked team there feel like an NCAA tournament team come the spring?
Yeah, they quite honestly, this team probably should be in an NIT venue because that's about how good this team looks right now. I mean, a lot of losses from a team that wasn't that good last year, barely made the NCAA tournament. Samardo Samuels, who was their best player last year, made a very surprising decision to go pro early. And this is now a very thin team. If Rick Pitino can channel his Providence, early Kentucky, running, gunning, pressing kind of wildfire teams, then that may suit this team better than anything, and they may have a chance to overachieve. But right now, they look like a lot of the Big East looks, which is very questionable. I mean, this is not going to be a great year, I don't think, in the Big East, at least compared to what we've seen the last couple of years.
Kansas State will begin the season ranked ahead of Kansas. Is this as much an oddity as it appears to me to be?
Well, Kansas State lasted longer last year than Kansas did in the tournament. They've come a long way in a short amount of time. Frank Martin, the coach who looks like his head is going to explode every 5 minutes on the sidelines, but really has a great personality when you get to know him. I really like him, and he's got one of the best three or four guards in the country, and Jacob Pullen, very athletic front court. Good defensive players, and I would put them ahead of Kansas to start with, too, although Kansas, certainly, given the talent level there, you can never count them out.
What other teams especially warrant a mention before the season begins, Pat?
Well, I was kind of thinking about this last year. I have to say that in our preview package on ESPN.com, before the season started, I predicted Butler to the Final Four, and I was trying to figure out if I could do anything to make myself look that smart this time around, and the answer is probably no. But one school that's kind of off the radar that I think is really going to be pretty darn good is Wichita State in the Missouri Valley Conference. Lost a very close, contentious final in that tournament to Northern Iowa, who went on to beat Kansas and had that great run of their own. But keep an eye on Butler, too. Even though they lost Gordon Hayward and some other guys, they're going to be very good again.
There was good news this week for Iowa's basketball program, which will not be penalized for allowing recruits to meet celebrities Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore. The NCAA ruled that meeting was purely accidental. Don't accidents like that happen to USC and UCLA recruits all the time? or maybe the question should be, what was Demi Moore doing in Iowa?
That is the question. Absolutely, that was the biggest upset that I heard from that whole thing. Is she's hanging out at Iowa football games? Wow, they've got a little more pull there in Iowa City than any of us thought. That's the kind of violation you kind of almost don't mind getting up here if you're in my mind.
The Pac-10 Conference Tournament won't take place until March, of course, but it should be an interesting one because it will include men's and women's games. Why the change, and do you think other conferences will adopt a similar format?
I kind of like the idea, especially if there's a difficulty filling the arena. And, sometimes some of these schools may not travel as well for conference tournaments, so if you can be inclusive and again, give the women a chance to play in a big-time venue with a bigger crowd, I think it helps them. And again, probably another way to give the women a little bit more of an equal playing field in terms of exposure and the perks that come with playing college basketball.
Of course, I'm sure that Tennessee and Connecticut and other conferences altogether are hoping that this development catches on, because then the men would be on the coattails of the women's teams there.
Absolutely. Tennessee's men's team, they need lessons from the women in a lot of areas, not just how to win, but also perhaps how to abide by NCAA rules. If you know what's going on there with the ongoing investigation of Tennessee men's basketball, and then you could say the same about UConn, which is under investigation as well.
Likely to be a while, I guess, before somebody gets the idea to have a conference tournament in which the women play against the men.
Probably so, although... You know, UConn, that wouldn't be a bad matchup, Tennessee or Baylor, for that matter. I wouldn't mind seeing any of those games.
You can read Pat Forte's 40-yard dash column on ESPN's website. He occasionally joins me from November to April each college basketball season. Pat, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoy the season.
The phrase sprint football might conjure up images of Usain Bolt in shoulder pads, but as Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports, sprint football is just like regular college football with one big, or actually small, difference.
It's a crisp, clear October Saturday in Waterbury, Connecticut, a perfect day for football, and Post University is preparing to host Mansfield University of Pennsylvania. As game time approaches, the parking lot at Municipal Stadium is full, and some Post fans are still tailgating. Inside the stadium, the crowd's ready for its first taste of sprint football. In today's major college football programs, it's not hard to pick out the linemen. Just look for the guys who are 300 pounds or pretty close to it. But in sprint football, it's not uncommon to see a running back standing shoulder to shoulder with a defensive tackle. That's because sprint players have to weigh 172 pounds or less. Otherwise, the game follows NCAA football rules, but the athletes still get a lot of questions about their sport from fellow students. Eli Morgan plays linebacker for Mansfield.
They don't understand that it's all the same football, you know, it's just the weight restriction. They're always asking, you know, is it flag football, is it touch football? And you just have to explain to them, like, you know, everything's the same, it's just the kids are a lot smaller.
The Collegiate Sprint Football League, or CSFL, was founded as the Eastern 150-pound Football League in 1934. The weight limit has been raised several times since to keep up with the average size of male college students. For many years, the sport was known as lightweight football. Steve Erber is Cornell University's Associate Director of Athletics and also serves as the league's commissioner.
The way regular college football has kind of morphed, size is quite important, and this enables these young guys that have been high school football players but aren't big enough to play in college, including Division III college, it provides them an opportunity to play another 4 years of football.
To play in CSFL games, athletes must successfully weigh in on Monday and again on Wednesday before a Friday game. Players cannot use saunas or other drastic measures for dropping weight and have to pass hydration tests. They're also required to have at least 5% body fat. There are small players who don't have to worry about the weight limit, but bigger players like Post tight end Rashawn Reed and center Chris Maceda are constantly aware of the cutoff line.
The challenge was trying to get 172. I was 180, 185.
What kinds of things did you have to do to get to the right weight?
Work hard.
Yeah, work hard.
Lift, a lot of dieting. Like, I was in high school. I graduated 2009. I weighed 210 pounds. I was off for 2 years, and so I just worked hard, got down to the weight, and came and played here.
Despite sprint football's nearly 80-year history, the sport has remained small, pun intended. The CSFL has seven teams: Cornell, Penn, Princeton, Army, Navy, Mansfield, and Post. The league requires schools to treat the sport as a varsity, not club sport, and squads play six or seven games a season. Post University co-captains Lee Knight and Kyle Lagasse both played regular football at other small colleges during their freshman years, but transferred to Post even though the school did not have football at all. Knight and Lagasse say when Post added sprint, it gave them one more unexpected chance to play.
I was at the point where I thought my football career was over, and then being able to have the opportunity again, you know, it was, I guess I can say, emotional for me. It felt great. You know, I love the sport.
For me, yeah, I had a year off from football. I thought I was done. I was going to school and I was working, and this came up, and I was like, hey, I have the rest of my life to work. What's another 3 years of football? It's going to be fun.
Other than the size difference, quickness is what sprint coaches and players talk about most. Post head coach Pete Ewald played football at Syracuse in the 1980s and has also coached in traditional programs.
You know, my quarterback put it in real good perspective. He said, you know, in high school I could run away from the linemen. In this league, I can't run away from the linemen because they're just as fast as me. That is probably, in a nutshell, the biggest thing players have to adjust to is that they can't run away from people because everyone is basically the same speed.
Post University's game against Mansfield is historic for the Eagles. This is the first football team Post has fielded in its 120-year history. The Eagles are playing a shortened schedule before becoming a full CSFL member next season. Today's game is Post's first home game and their final game of the season. As the Post players head out for warm-ups, there's no question they're excited.
Let's go, baby!
As the game begins, the bleachers behind the Post bench are packed. The announced attendance is 1,007, and the crowd gets their first Eagles highlight on the opening kickoff. Mansfield fumbles, and the Eagles recover deep in Mountaineers territory. Among the fans are students Greg Greer and Yardley Marsland. It's obvious they're ready for some football. They've both painted their faces green and their hair white, Post's school colors.
It's very exciting. The players are really good. They're doing as best as they could.
Everything goes by so fast because they're so small.
Here in Waterbury, Post University Sprint football is off to a strong start. But the school where the sport means the most might be Mansfield. The small university in Pennsylvania had a Division II football program for 115 years before dropping it after the 2006 season for financial reasons. The Sprint program was established in 2008, and now Mansfield draws 2,000 to 3,000 fans per home game. Army Sprint football head coach Lieutenant Colonel Mike McElrath played on Army's regular team. He says at West Point and other schools with two football programs, Sprint will always be overshadowed. But at Mansfield, and now Post, it's the main event.
Now, we have our own fan base that we get for our home games. But, like, when we went to Mansfield, it was everything you would expect at a college football game. The Sprint team is the Mansfield football team. The band is there, cheerleaders. It was by far the most well-attended game that we played this season. I mean, it's a game day experience.
In the second quarter, Post scores first, but the Mountaineers quickly pull ahead. The Eagles keep things lively with two near-miss chances to take the lead in the final minutes. But in the end, Mansfield comes out on top, 7-6, spoiling Post's inaugural home opener. Mansfield's running game looked strong, and Post connected on some excellent passes. But the teams also showed their inexperience, combining for 20 penalties and 13 turnovers, and generating the lowest point total of any Sprint game this season. But Mansfield Sports Information Director Steve McCloskey says it will take more than one sloppy game to dampen either team's enthusiasm.
We have some kids here that are 5'2" and 5'3" and 140 pounds. And even in the sprint world, that's small. That's really small. But they're on that kickoff team. And when that ball is kicked off, that kid is running down that field. He thinks he's 6'5 and 240 pounds, and he's running down in a major college football game. And shouldn't we all be able to have that thrill of being able to think that way? It's great.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, he mentioned one of the golfers looking to supplant Tiger Woods as number one in the world. His mispronunciation of said golfer's name inspired Charlie Bell, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, New York, to wax poetic. "Do you know," our host asked, "after Tiger's long run, who'll inherit the title of world's number one?" Charlie paused and said, "Maybe that Westwood guy, Lee, or some dude I don't know, Martin Kamer, tee hee. Hey, it's only a name, and I'm just a lame rhymer, but the German's got game, and his name's Martin Keimer." As old friend Ned Martin, late the voice of the Red Sox, used to say, not too shabby. My conversation last week with Sports Illustrated editor Terry McDonald, the guy who's responsible for picking the cover of the magazine each week, provoked several responses. Mr. McDonald maintained that the so-called Sports Illustrated cover jinx began when Oklahoma, proclaimed unbeatable on the cover in 1957, lost. Nancy Kriplin was an editorial trainee at Time, Inc., the magazine's parent company, during the mid-50s, and she wrote to say, "I would date the jinx to something darker. I remember we began talking about it shortly after Jill Kinmont appeared on the cover in January 1955, and that same week had a horrendous crash which left her paralyzed." Linda Mitchell was also responding to that interview when she wrote, "Bill, I hold you in the highest esteem for trying ever so gently to lead Mr. McDonald into an admission of institutional sexism, but I'm sorry you didn't nail his arse to the wall with more vigor. Give me Annika over Tiger any day of the week. She's in great company with all the other amazing women whose athletic accomplishments and honorable lives have been ignored by Sports Illustrated." Of last week's Halloween tale about the allegedly haunted hotel in Milwaukee, which is home to teams visiting the Brewers, Bill Wright wrote, "The only question I had following the wonderful story about the Pfister Hotel concerns Charles Pfister himself. Was he a baseball fan? Maybe he is still trying to help out the hometown club." And finally, to all the listeners who've recently asked about the music on the program, you can peruse each week's selections on the music blog at onlyagame.org. You can also get in touch with us there or by leaving a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At Nuance.com. This is NPR.
Tonight, as part of the Edenbridge Bonfire Society's celebration of Guy Fawkes Day, the Kent-based group will set aflame a 49-foot-high effigy of Manchester United's Wayne Rooney. The statue, which holds a bag of money, has been equipped with green Shrek-style ears to accentuate the soccer star's alleged resemblance to the cartoon ogre, and it has been packed with fireworks to ensure the ensuing blaze will disappoint no one. In the past, the Society has built and destroyed effigies of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown and model Katie Price. Of this year's effigy, Edenbridge Bonfire Society member Charles Labor has said, "I hate football myself, so I'm quite happy to burn a footballer." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with golf great Annika Sorenstam. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Monday night, the San Francisco Giants won the North American Baseball Championship, a.k.a. the World Series. The last time the Giants won the series, I was 6 years old, so I guess it's no wonder they're still celebrating in San Francisco. And I see that you've grown a beard in honor of reliever Brian Wilson and his bearded teammates.
Have you forgiven them from leaving New York yet?
No.
I mean, is this okay? Is it okay now that they're in San Francisco?
I'm glad Honestly, they won. I will say that.
I think, among other people, Edgar Renteria, when he's old and sitting by his fire, is going to have interesting tales to tell.
And none of them will include the Boston Red
Sox. That's right.
Derek Jeter is a free agent. Do you think there is really any chance the Yankees will let him depart New York?
No, but I think it's interesting that it was even raised as an on-the-record possibility by Hal Steinbrenner. Make him player X and give him the same statistics and the same age and the same wear and tear. And there's no question that there would be a controversy about re-signing him. But the guy's the embodiment of everything that's happened there in the last 30 years. I don't think there's any way they're going to do that.
Among the other 141 players on the free agent list, Mariano Rivera, Carl Crawford, and Manny Ramirez. Maybe the Yankees will get them all.
I don't know. You know, I think the Yankees are aiming primarily at Cliff Lee, and I think they'll probably get him. The persistent rumor is that Carl Crawford is target A, B, and C for the Red Sox. Manny, who knows? I mean, he's almost got to come back to the American League at this point.
Charlie, on Thursday, Sparky Anderson, who managed the Reds and the Tigers to World Series championships, died. He was 76. Have you Sparky stories to share?
Well, as you know, my favorite old ballpark of all time in any sport was Tiger Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things about going to Tiger Stadium when I was following baseball teams around was that you got to hang out with Sparky for a while. He was fun. He was completely in love with what he did for a living. My favorite moment, though, actually, a scrub infielder named Jim Whalewander one day brought his favorite band, the Dead Milkmen, to the ball game. And Sparky came out of his office and looked at Dave Blood and Jimmy Jack Talcum and the boys and said, "Them guys don't get much sun, do they?" He will be incredibly missed.
Randy Moss played for the Patriots in September. In October, he played for the Vikings. This week, he'll be playing for the Tennessee Titans. What about December?
Maybe he can play for a different team every week.
Cool.
No, the one thing this will do is if Vince Young ever gets back on the field down there, it will probably set Vince Young's development as a professional quarterback back about five seasons because the temptation to just fling it down the field will be overwhelming.
This week, Taylor Twellman, who starred for the New England Revolution and briefly for the national team, announced his retirement. He's only 30 years old, but he's barely played since sustaining a concussion 2 years ago. I wonder, does Twellman's predicament indicate the need to expand the head injury debate beyond the NFL?
Oh, there's no question, and this has been a sub rosa discussion in soccer for quite some time now. I mean, it's quite obvious how you get a concussion in soccer. You hit the ball with your head
or somebody
repeatedly
else's head
really
with your
hard
head.
Or you hit right. somebody else's head. The primary medical advice in a situation like this is, "Doc, it hurts when I do this. Don't do it. Don't come back until you're absolutely sure."
Former Mississippi State quarterback John Bond has accused the camp of current Auburn quarterback and Heisman favorite Cam Newton of soliciting cash while Newton was being recruited. That ought to ramp up the SEC rivalry, don't you think?
Yeah, this will be very interesting. This is being taken enormously seriously by both the media, in particular CBS Sports, and by the NCAA. I don't know whether somebody has the guts to go into this and maybe suspend Newton halfway through an undefeated season in which he's on his way to the Heisman Trophy, but the Reggie Bush thing makes anything possible at this point.
Usually when college players encounter this sort of controversy, the coach and the athletic director just hold them out until the controversy can be cleared. This guy was simply too good for
there's
them to
no
think about doing that.
There's no chance of that. No, right. There's absolutely no chance of that.
This weekend, Olympic gold medalist Cammy Granato of the hockey-playing Granados will be inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto, the first as far as a woman getting that distinction.
And the fact that she helped beat the Canadians won't matter because, as we know, Bill, all is one in the universe of hockey. The country of hockey knows no borders.
Very few athletes get to retire undefeated. But Zenyatta may earn that distinction at the Breeders' Cup Classic this afternoon. Apparently, the betting... Five means under... You're going to go all the way to 19?
No, I'd say 8-5.
Apparently, the betting public likes the fact that Zenyatta will retire undefeated with 20 wins. Huge favorite.
Yes, an 8-5 favorite in the Classic. It could very well be a coronation. I did like the fact that she flew in on her own private jet. Which I thought was very cool.
Well, if you won 19 in a row, you probably would get your
They're not loading this horse into one of those trailers you see on the turnpike.
Before this week, were you aware of the involvement of the Nike Corporation in wedding apparel?
No, I wasn't. I was also not aware that part of my job as only a game sports analyst is to know that Maria Sharapova designs shoes.
Yes.
But apparently it is.
And they're
sports!
Nike shoes for
yes,
her wedding.
Yeah, she's going to marry, of course, L.A. Lakers third-string shooting guard Sasha Vujacic, and she's going to be wearing Cole Haan, which is apparently a Nike brand, and I didn't know that before I sat down here today. So I'm very happy for the happy couple.
Yes. Do you suppose on his tuxedo there'll be a big swoosh?
I think probably on the minister's robes there'll be that big swoosh.
And across the front of the church
Absolutely.
There'll be a big swoosh.
Or perhaps they'll just go to the Church of Nike.
And they'll drive off to their honeymoon in a big swoosh. All right, finally, Charlie, I'm not a big tweeter. Much of the idiom of the internet escapes me. Can you explain to me all the fuss about the Wakefield High track and field team and their new apparel?
They put together shirts for Wakefield track and field that said WTF, which is, as the kids will tell you out there on the intertubes, an acronym for what the, and you can fill in the last word. So apparently...
Field,
very good. What the field? Excellent. This has become one of those things, of course, where we all get worried about what's happening with the youth. I'm waiting for the first one of these to show up on eBay for $10,000.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other things. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Annika Sorenstam was the LPGA's Player of the Year in 1995, and over the next 10 years, she earned that distinction 7 more times. She is a Hall of Famer, and on one especially unlikely day in 2001, she shot a 59. I wonder if she lies awake nights thinking about how it could have been a 58. Anyway, when she retired at the end of 2008, Annika Sorenstam was certainly the face of women's golf. She may have been the face of women's sports, and she joins me now from WUCF in Orlando, Florida, where she lives. Annika Sorenstam, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You had 89 professional wins, including 10 LPGA major tournaments. You were the first LPGA golfer to reach career earnings of more than $20 million. You became a household name in the process of accomplishing those things, but I'd like to have you tell us how you first came to play golf while growing up in Sweden.
Well, sure. I mean, when you think of Sweden, you might not think of golf. You know, we're known for ABBA, we're known for Swedish meatballs, maybe, you know, soccer and ice hockey. But golf is really a big sport. It's one of the top five sports in the country. So I was introduced to the game by my parents, and we lived about 5 minutes from a golf course. And to be honest, in the beginning, I thought it was a little slow. It felt like a game for older people. I was involved with tennis, and I played soccer and everything that had to do with the ball, but also downhill skiing. So I did all kinds of sports growing up, but golf was just something that my parents really enjoyed, and my sister and I would go out there and see our parents and just putt a little bit, hit a little bit, but it took a while before we really got interested in the game.
How old were you when your parents decided it was time for you to start playing golf?
Well, they introduced us early. As a matter of fact, my mom, she claims that I got my rhythm when she was pregnant with me because she was playing golf then. So she claims that I got the rhythm early on. But it wasn't until probably the age of 12 where I went to a junior camp for the first time and really got an established handicap. And that's, you know, when I learned, you know, the true fundamentals of the game. And really that's kind of where it sparked my interest.
You've earned just about every golfing honor, but despite your success, you've never appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Now, last week, I spoke with Terry McDonald, the editor of the Sports Illustrated Group and the man responsible for choosing the cover subjects, and he apologized for the omission. When I speak to Mr. McDonald again, can I tell him that you accept his apology?
Yes, please tell him that. I mean, they really don't have a lot of women on the cover, so... But, you know, I'm still involved in the game. I just don't compete. So if they want to have, you know, still not too late. So you can tell them that.
I will. I'll pass that along. When you retired at the end of the 2008 season, you said you and your husband, Mike McGee, wanted to begin a family. So tell us a little bit about your daughter, Ava Madeline.
Yep, Ava Madeline. She's 14 months now, and she's certainly the joy of our life. I mean, she is my grand slam. I'm enjoying every minute with her. To see her experience every day, it's just it's so much fun. And taking her on the golf course a few times, and she loves it. She has a golf bag, shoes, and balls, and hats, and she's ready. It's fun to just see her. I mean, she's more waving the club and putting the ball in her mouth at this time. But, you know, as far as introducing her seriously to the game, it really will be up to her. But my goal is to be supportive and be there for her.
Your charitable organization, the Annika Foundation, focuses on children's health and nutrition and provides resources for junior golfers. Tell us about some of the foundation's recent projects.
That is correct, yes. I mean, for many years I've been giving out scholarships, awards to junior girls and boys just to inspire them to play the game. And then when I stepped away from competition about 2 years ago, we started the Anika Invitational, which is a junior tournament for girls around the world. Last year we had 14 different nations represented, and it was 72 girls, you know, up to the age of 18. And it's we teach them the importance of eating right and being active and so forth. So things that I think are very important to live healthy and active. A few months ago, we gave out five different grants to schools here in the Orlando area to make sure that they have physical education programs in school, because unfortunately they're taking it off the schedule. So I'm excited about this. I'm passionate about it. And it's just amazing to see these kids smile when they can be active and feel good.
It's probably not fair to blame the decline in the number of LPGA events on your retirement, although there were 34 such events in 2008, 27 of them in 2009, and 24 of them this year. What does account for that decline?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's sad to see the decline. I mean, I think that the last few years have been tough. A lot of sponsorships dollar has been cut, and So it's unfortunate, because I must say that the product, the players, I mean, they're playing great golf. We have an international flavor of players, and you know, the girls are very approachable, and it's been hard to see. I mean, these girls are making a living, and they've worked very, very hard to get there, and now it's a little tougher for them. But I do, like I said, I do believe in the product, and we have a new commissioner, and I'm thinking that he's gonna direct the tour in a better direction. And when the economy turns around, I think the LPGA is in a good place. The fan base is still there. It's just we got to get back to getting some of the companies to sponsor the tour. But it's a tough situation right now.
You were very active in trying to get golf included in the Olympics, and it will be in the 2016 Games in Brazil. Tell me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I was ambassador together with Jack Nicklaus, and I actually went to Geneva this past June to present it to IOC why golf should be an Olympic sport. And it was quite the experience. I mean, it's a tough crowd, but I think golf has so much to offer. It really does, and I think it will do a lot for the game as well. Golf is a big sport here, but it's only so much more it can grow. So obviously, I mean, the goal is to get the best players to compete. I think it'll be really, really exciting. And, you know, I look back in my career and, you know, something that I don't have is a gold medal or silver or bronze Olympic medal. I mean, a lot of athletes can say that in their own sport, but not in golf. So it will be exciting to follow when it does take place in 2016.
Well, you said it's not too late for Sports Illustrated to put you on the cover. Maybe it's not not too late for you to be an Olympian from Sweden or from the U.S. I'm not sure which country you'd represent at this point.
Well, maybe that will be my in.
There was a lot of fanfare back in 2003 when you played in a men's tournament, the PGA's Bank of America Colonial in Fort Worth. You missed the cut in that tournament, but are you glad you tried to play with the male golfers? And do you think other women on the LPGA Tour should try that?
I am very, very glad that I did that. I mean, I look back in my career and it's probably one of the highlights. For me, it was really just a personal challenge. I wanted to play with the best golfers in the world. I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to really put my game out there and see what I was made out of. I learned a lot about myself, a lot about my game. So it really helped me on so many levels. And as far as other women competing on the men's tour, I mean, we've seen it a few times with Michelle Wee, and I think we'll see it on occasion, but not something regularly. I mean, there is a big difference in our golf games, obviously for some natural reasons.
And now you're raising a little girl, you're traveling around the world still playing lots of golf, running several businesses, or being involved at least in several businesses, so about as busy as anybody could possibly be. But are there times when you miss the kind of competition provided on the LPGA Tour?
The honest answer is no. I do not miss it at all. I have not looked back. You know, there's so much more to life than competing, and I'm very happy I stepped away. I'm enjoying another part of life that I just haven't experienced before. And, You know, and I look back at my career and I'm very happy what I've achieved, and nothing is going to make me as content as I am. So now I can put my energy and my passion into other areas.
Annika Sorenstam, whose resume lacks nothing but an appearance on the cover of Sports Illustrated, joined me from WUCF in Orlando. Annika, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from WUCF in Orlando, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Doug Trabu's really tiny sprint football pictures or Karen's predictably big Dallas photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from winemaker and fun lover Annika Sorenstam.
And we created the concept Wine, Nine, and Dine.
I would think most people would like to play 18, but wouldn't it be mean for me to make a scene about that distinction? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. If it makes you feel sad, and I understand, you've come to shake my hand. I apologize. Support comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. This is NPR.